The last case on our calendar is 06-1190, Disciplinary Counsel versus Mark Michael Simonelli.
Yes. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, my name is Tim Brick and I represent the respondent, Mark Simonelli. Unfortunately, Mr. Simonelli continues to experience severe health problems. He's medically unable to attend today. This is a very important matter to him and he is with us via the internet stream. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Watch your time.
I'd like to start out by saying that in August of 2002, Mr. Simonelli made a mistake. He was approached by James Worsing of WJW Enterprises, a so-called foreclosure consultant, and asked to accept referrals, including bankruptcy referrals. It turns out that WJW was not a reputable company, and to put it bluntly, Mr. Worsing's a crook. He stole money from clients, including $2,000 from Barbara Fletcher, and someday he probably will wind up in jail. Did not take Mr. Simonelli very long to figure out that this was not a good company, and he severed his relationship and refused to take any referrals a little bit over 4 months after they started. In that short period of time, Mr. Simonelli received a handful of bankruptcy referrals in the Dayton Court, Southern District of Ohio. That is why we're here today, the Barbara Fletcher, Amy Wolf, and Haynes bankruptcies. Mr. Simonelli didn't know it at the time, but when he accepted those Dayton bankruptcy cases, he was walking into a very adversarial situation. Apparently, the Chapter 13 trustee in Dayton had had prior problems with WJW. Staff attorney Scott Stout was assigned to investigate WJW. And I think it's pretty clear that Mr. Simonelli was prejudged by the trustee. Was treated unfairly in many ways and certainly held to a higher standard than other lawyers. It's too bad that
he wasn't given a heads up right away.
No, he wasn't given a heads up. He had no reason to believe that there was a problem in Dayton because certainly he did nothing wrong in Dayton before, on the first day of his filing.
But he wasn't admitted there, was he?
I believe that that was an issue that he was admitted properly, Your Honor. Under the local rules of the Southern District, he was admitted to practice bankruptcy law in the Northern District, and he filed notices of appearances, which I believe satisfied that obligation. The point I was trying to make is that this disciplinary complaint is being driven by the Chapter 13 trustee in Dayton, certainly not being driven by the clients. No client here filed a disciplinary complaint. In fact, Barbara Fletcher to this day still has no idea what it is that Mr. Simonelli allegedly did wrong.
I mean, judges not only do but are required under our rules to make complaints when they believe violations.
Yes, I understand, Your Honor, but I think it is significant here that the clients have, at least one client has no idea what it is her lawyer supposedly did wrong.
Well, that wouldn't necessarily be, that's not terribly significant. Many clients wouldn't know what all the rules of professional responsibility are.
That is true, Your Honor. We don't believe, based on the record before you, that the realtor has satisfied its burden of producing clear and convincing evidence of the ethical violations. I think it's important to understand in these cases that these were all emergency situations. In each case, the client's home was already scheduled for a sale in the foreclosure proceeding before Mr. Simonelli ever got a referral. And the primary interest of all these clients was to save their homes. And Mr. Simonelli took the steps necessary to prevent the foreclosure sales. He immediately came in and he filed these emergency petitions. He filed the appropriate pleading in the foreclosure action, stopped the sale. That was the primary objective. And then he did follow up and I believe advanced the client's interests in the process. He filed the necessary schedules and Chapter 13 plans in the Wolf and Fletcher bankruptcies on time. And those ultimately were approved. The Haynes petition was dismissed, but through no neglect on the part of Mr. Simonelli. turns out, and Mrs. Haynes testified, that they simply didn't have enough money to fund the Chapter 13 plan. Mr. Simonelli, as a respondent, has filed objections to the findings, conclusions, and recommendations of the Board of Commissioners, and I would submit to you that the report certified to this court is fundamentally flawed in many ways, and it shouldn't be allowed to stand, and that Mr. Simonelli shouldn't lose his privilege of practicing law in the state of Ohio based on the report certified to this court.
We found in Stranke, who did also work for WJW,
yes,
that he should be suspended for 6 months.
Yes.
What is different about your client's conduct from Stranke that would merit a different sanction?
I'm happy to answer that question, and I think I'm uniquely qualified to do it since I also represented Mr. Stranke. It is a different situation with Mr. Stranke. What he did, he did not maintain an independent practice. He did not quote a separate fee to the clients. He was paid directly by WJW. There was a finding by the bankruptcy judge in Dayton that Mr. Stranke had falsified certain documents, and I believe it was the 2016B about the disclosure of fees. Totally different situation because Mr. Simonelli here, as we'll get into the fee splitting thing, he quoted the fees. The clients knew and understood that they had to pay them separately. So I have to tell you that once there was a finding by a federal bankruptcy judge that there were falsified records, that pretty much was the end of, there was no real defense to that. But it was based on a different situation. Mr. Stranke did what he had to do. He admitted he made a mistake. And he entered into an agreement with disciplinary counsel. But the facts are different from this case based on that. So I don't think that you can say, well, Stranke, this happened to Stranke, has to happen to Mr. Simonelli. If I could, I'd like to discuss the due process issue that we raised because it was troubling to me. And I think it's pretty clear that the hearing panel went out of its way to make up new charges against Mr. Simonelli after the fact. And relied on inadmissible evidence. And to tell you the truth, this was a complete blindside to the respondent. I personally was shocked when I read the opinion, and there were all these new charges that were used to support the findings that were never, ever a part of these proceedings. And let me use the most glaring example, and that is the board's reliance on Paulette Yamblis. Ms. Yamblis is a bankruptcy attorney. She covered the Section 341 hearing on behalf of Mr. Simonelli in the Fletcher matter. There's no rule that prohibits that. Scott Stout, he testified to that. And there was it was of no consequence. Nothing bad happened there. And Paulette Yamblis was never a part of these proceedings. She's not referenced in the disciplinary complaint. She wasn't identified by a realtor as a witness. She didn't testify at the hearing. And I just reread the transcript, and I saw her name mentioned a grand total of two times for about 5 seconds worth of...
Well, what did they conclude about your client that was wrong?
Well, this is what the board concluded, that I was shocked at this, that Mr. Simonelli had violated the most serious charge, the DR1-204, the fraud charge, based on the fact that he didn't disclose a fee-sharing arrangement with Paulette Yamblis. That was never part of this case. There was no testimony introduced to that, and apparently they pulled that out of a pleading, an unverified pleading that was filed in a sanctions proceeding with those allegations. So this was a situation where...
So he didn't do that?
Absolutely not. And in fact, if the board would have, or the hearing panel would have bothered to read his response, there was an affidavit where he totally denied all this. But the point is, Your Honor, is that there was no testimony.
Denied which? That he didn't tell the client, or denied that he had a fee-sharing agreement?
Denied that he had any type of fee-sharing relationship with Paulette Yamblis. But the problem on the due process side here is that no testimony was elicited about that because it was never an issue. It really violates the sense of a fair play here when there's a finding of the most serious charge after the fact, and there's absolutely no evidence supported. You know, we have to be able to defend these claims as lawyers, and clearly The panel went outside the scope of the charge, and these statements were hearsay statements, and there's just no way that this court should approve of that. The fee splitting issue, I think, is significant.
Let me just stop you there. The board, or the panels, the board's recommendation, page 10, I'm sure you know, speaks to the charge of the sharing legal fees with a non-lawyer.
Yes.
That's what you're complaining about, is that right?
Well, no, I think that, well, they do. They say that there's a violation. They're all over the board, the panel was, that they said that.
But they give all their reasons, and it seems as if this about the $2,000 a week and so forth, was that not in the record or not?
Well, the $2,000 a week in terms of what Mr. Seminole, he did two things. He represented clients in the foreclosure proceedings. That's a separate matter. There was no charge about the foreclosure proceedings here, and he was paid differently for that. He was paid $2,000 a week by WJW to represent clients in the foreclosure actions. That's separate. He had a separate arrangement with his clients that were bankruptcy referrals. He was paid directly by them, and that, I guess, is another part of the due process. There was no charge that was in the disciplinary complaint that was improper, and in fact, it's not on its face improper. There are disciplinary rules that allow for that.
Well, is it possible that that when the charges are filed, the disciplinary counsel doesn't know all of the conduct, and so in the process of at least the panel hearing, the panel finds facts that perhaps weren't revealed when or weren't apparent when the complaint was filed.
Well, two responses to that. One, in this case, disciplinary counsel did understand the relationship when they filed the complaint, and so that they did understand. They just decided not to charge on this. And then, second, if you read the cases that we've cited, no, you can't do that. Even if something new comes out in the hearing, you can't make new charges after the fact. In that case. You know, maybe you could open up a new case or something like that, but you can't.
You're
do
raising
it.
A due process issue, are
absolutely,
you?
Absolutely, Your
are
Honor.
Are you not?
Yes. It's absolutely a due process issue.
And how can you characterize it other is it the $2,000 per week charge?
No, it's really this Paulette Yamblis is the most serious one. How are you going to hold a lawyer responsible for the most serious charge when this is a new allegation that you don't even know is at issue? How do you defend against that? If we had to call Paulette Yamblis to cross-examine her, we would have done it. But she wasn't even identified as a witness by the realtor.
Although
we had no idea.
At page 6 of the opinion,
yes.
Doesn't it say that there was a stipulated Exhibit 17?
Yes.
This fact was stipulated to
your
client?
Oh, absolutely not. I think that's a little bit disingenuous, Your Honor.
There is not a stipulated Exhibit 17.
Excuse me, I'll let you finish. All the pleadings that were filed in the bankruptcy case, we stipulated to their authenticity. But in terms of saying, I know there was an argument what we waived our ability to object to these hearsay statements in a complaint because this plea, there's this pleading that was filed. Of course, the pleading was filed. I don't think there's a big difference in my mind between.
You stipulated to the authenticity of the document, but did not stipulate to the facts contained therein. Is that?
Well, certainly not the hearsay statements that you're going to prove your case on that.
So how's the board supposed to understand what you're stipulating to if that's the way you practice law?
Well, Judge, I think that the issue is that if the realtor had an obligation to make this an issue, and it shouldn't come up after the fact based on hearsay statements contained in, whether it's stipulated to document or not doesn't mean it's not hearsay. But they should have called Paulette Yamblis in, and then we could have litigated that issue.
Well, is your issue then an evidentiary issue about her testimony, or is it a due process
issue? It's both.
Well, Exhibit 17 is a memorandum, and as Justice Lanzinger's pointed out, it indicates that you had agreed to a fee-sharing arrangement with Paulette Yamblis without providing information on the 2016 B statement.
Your Honor, that's one pleading. That statement's made in a pleading. That's a hearsay statement. So it's a due process in that the realtor didn't raise that as a
relator.
Complaint.
Relator. It's not realtor.
I'm sorry, relator. I apologize. The relator did not advocate or did not charge on that issue. That was not part of the case ever. And it's an evidentiary issue because that statement's still hearsay. All right. right, I'm okay. Running out of time here. I'll be happy to, I'll reserve my rights and come back up.
Thank you, Mr. Burke. Ms. Beckman.
Good morning. May it please the court. Stacey Solacek Beckman on behalf of the Relator. I want to address several of the things that Mr. Brick has mentioned, and I want to start by answering the question that Justice Stratton asked, is how is this matter different than disciplinary counsel versus Stranky? And the answer to that, which is different than Mr. Brick's answer, is that it is both the same and different. The conduct that's alleged in this case, that's alleged that respondent Mr. Simonelli engaged in, is exactly the same as the conduct that was alleged in Stranky. In Stranky, Mr. Stranky represented two clients that were referred to him by WJW. In both of those cases, he never met with his clients, he never spoke with his clients, he never gave the counseling necessary in order to properly counsel and guide a bankruptcy client. In both of those cases, he made misrepresentations to the bankruptcy court by indicating in Exhibit B, the same thing that he did in this case in both Mrs. Fletcher's and Amy Wolf's bankruptcies, that he had in fact told them the different remedies available. Exactly the same. In the same case as with Stranky, on the 2016, the disclosure of fees, in both Barbara Fletcher's case and in Amy Wolf's case, the respondent indicated that he had received the fees from the debtor. That's exactly what Stranky did. Those facts are exactly the same. The conduct is exactly the same. The way that the case is different, however, is that contrary to the respondent, Mr. Stranky acknowledged the wrongful nature of his conduct. He admitted that what he had done was wrong. He entered into a discipline by consent, and he was suspended for 6 months. We would assert that because there is not that mitigation, that the sanction in this case should be greater, as the board found. The second issue I want to address that was raised by Mr. Brick is this issue involving Paulette Yamblis. The relator did not charge any allegations relating to the foreclosures. The relator didn't know about those allegations, to be honest with you, when it filed the complaint. It only learned how Mr. Simonelli and WJW worked the foreclosures at the time that it took Mr. Simonelli's deposition. Regardless, they were not included as part of the formal complaint. Stipulated Exhibit 17 was stipulated as to both its authenticity and its admissibility. That's exactly what the stipulations read. The panel considered the information relating to Paulette Yamblis.
So are you saying that counsel just made a very important misrepresentation to this court a few moments ago?
I am saying that I'm not sure counsel read the stipulations closely. I'm not sure that he was necessarily aware that that's what that opening paragraph says. I certainly am not suggesting that he made a misrepresentation to this court. The hearsay statements can be considered by the board. But even if this court finds that those issues, whether the fee sharing was disclosed on the 2016 and therefore violates 1102A4, and whether or not the foreclosure payments, the $2,000 a week, violated 3102A, even if this court considers that the respondent's due process rights may have been violated because that wasn't raised in the formal complaint and he didn't have a chance to answer it, the fact remains that Relator established by clear and convincing evidence each of these violations without that information. For example, when you look at the neglect cases in Mrs. Fletcher's case, the respondent never met with her. He sent a runner on two occasions to have her sign important documents, and Mrs. Fletcher testified that she had no idea what she was signing or how it would affect her. He didn't show up at the 341 hearing, and while it is proper for him to have made arrangements for another attorney to appear on his behalf, he never told his client that someone else was coming, and he never explained to his client what was going to happen at that hearing.
Counsel, in mitigation, it's been represented to us that this lawyer discovered fairly quickly that he was working for someone who was at best dishonest and perhaps committing criminal conduct. and that he bailed out of this arrangement quickly. Is that what the facts represent in this case, or did he not bail until serious jeopardy was confronting him?
It appeared that he stopped representing individuals referred to him by WJW at or about the same time that he became aware that the difficulties with the trustee's office in Dayton existed.
Okay, so once the trustee made him aware, it is a fair representation. He terminated the relationship.
That is a fair representation. What I think may be an unfair representation, however, now that you mention it, is that the trustee's office acted unfairly towards the respondent in some way. The trustee's office became aware that there were issues involving WJW, primarily because the first attorney that started representing WJW in the bankruptcy court there was the same attorney that the respondent was having contact individuals to come and assist him, that the respondent had intended to appear for Amy Wolf at her hearing. It was John Lord who this court has previously disciplined for his conduct. So I think that it is somewhat disingenuous for the respondent to suggest that there was some type of hostile environment there, when in fact he was working with the same individual that was perpetuating part of that environment.
Mr. Brick seemed to rely heavily on the fact that there was unequal treatment of attorneys by the bankruptcy trustee. Did you sense any of that from the evidence received?
Your Honor, I don't believe that there's any evidence in the record that shows that there's unequal treatment by the trustee's office to Mr. Simonelli.
You raise the stipulation, and you know, you stipulate authenticity and admissibility. Does that give the board the right to levy a charge based on that stipulation alone, or do they have to amend the complaint? Don't they normally amend the complaint and say, here's a new charge, here's the evidence for it, but give him an opportunity then to defend? Because it does seem that he has some argument, even if he did stipulate to admissibility, that doesn't give rise to the ability to raise a charge that he's not put on notice of.
I agree with you, Your Honor. However, as I pointed out, I think regardless of whether or not this court finds that those charges were improperly raised, I believe that clear and convincing evidence exists to support a finding of violations of each of the rules charged anyways, based on the formal complaint that was filed.
Well, he says in fee splitting, he charged a separate fee, and whether the fee went directly to him, as it did apparently in one case, or it went to WJW and then paid over to him, shouldn't matter. What was the evidence that that wasn't the case?
Well, we disagree with that. We believe that the fee that was paid to WJW, Amy Wolf and Barbara Fletcher hired WJW to assist them in trying to avoid foreclosure. They knew going into that process that should WJW fail in its efforts, it would refer them to an attorney who would then help them in a bankruptcy. They paid WJW. In Mrs. Wolf's case, I believe she paid around $700. And in Barbara Fletcher's case, she paid almost $3,000. Neither of those checks were issued to WJW for $600, which is what the respondent charged for the legal fees. WJW maintained control over those funds the entire time until he gave those funds to Mr. Simonelli.
Did both clients deny that he quoted him a separate fee?
Well, Mrs. Wolf denies that she ever spoke with him. So she certainly denies that she was quoted a separate fee. Both clients readily admit that they were aware that a fee would be paid to him. The purpose of 3102A is to safeguard the lawyer's professional independence. And I think that by finding a violation in this case, and I understand that it is certainly a novel way of looking at 3102A, but that we accomplished that goal. And again, that would be the same type of violation that exists in Strankey, where in Strankey, while it was a weekly stipend, it was still money that the clients knew was going to WJW that would then be paid to the bankruptcy lawyer as part of that lawyer's fees.
Counsel, let's assume that we were to remove the Yamblis situation from our consideration here. Do you think that the recommended sanction then of the board also should be adjusted?
I do not. I don't believe that a finding that the respondent violated, for instance, 1102A4 because he failed to disclose that he had a fee-sharing arrangement with Paulette Yambliss enhances or decreases the sanction that was recommended, as the panel also found that he violated 1102A4 because he had indicated that he received the fee from the debtor when, in fact, he did not. He received the fee from WJW. And in the Amy Wolf matter, he indicated that he had, in fact, told her about the different remedies available when he had not, in fact, done so because Mrs. Wolf never spoke with him. The respondent has suggested that the sanction in this matter is inappropriate and has advocated that this court either dismiss the case or, in the alternative, issue a public reprimand. And by doing this, he's all but ignored the aggravating factors that the board found, that there was a pattern of misconduct, the multiple offenses, the refusal to acknowledge the wrongful nature of his conduct, and the vulnerability or harm of these clients. Again, these were individuals who were already going through a very desperate time in their lives, who were seeking to rely on someone, and the respondent failed to live up to his obligations. And although this court has deviated in cases from the bright line rule that where there is a finding of 1102A4, that an actual suspension should be found, I don't believe that this is a case that the court should deviate from that rule. In this case, the 1102A4 violations involve making misrepresentations on pleadings to a court. The relator would respectfully request that this court adopt the findings of fact, conclusions of law, and recommendation of the board, and suspend the respondent for 1 year, staying 6 months of that. If there's no further questions, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Beckman. Mr. Brick, you saved 30 seconds of your time.
So much to say and so little time, I suppose. I guess I'll just say, hit right to the heart of this, the most serious charge, the DR-102A4 with Mrs. Fletcher. The evidence was in a stipulation. He spoke to her beforehand. He explained to her the different bankruptcy things. So I don't see how that can be the basis for it. The 2016B, I don't believe, was a misrepresentation to the court. Certainly wasn't intentional if there was. This was an example of the trustee in Dayton wanting this form amended, and Mr. Simile agreed to do it. There's no material change if you look at those two forms from what he filed and what was submitted, and he specifically said in that, and no one challenged it, was that there was no fee split, simply that the money passed through hands. This is a case different than Stranke. Stranke, on the 2016B, falsified that report because he had a different pay structure. I think that with Amy Wolf, the same thing, the board even got that confused. They seemed to suggest that she didn't want a Chapter 13 bankruptcy when in fact she did. And I think that there's no evidence to support this intentional misconduct allegation. And that, of course, is the most serious one. And that is why we have asked that Mr. Simonelli not be receive, even if there's a finding that there's some violation here, that he not receive an actual suspension. If not a public recommend, then a suspended sentence.
Thank you, Mr. Brick. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.